Well, hey, everybody. My name is Mark, and welcome to this week's Menlo Midweek Podcast. Today, we are continuing the conversation around suffering as we looked at Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane this past weekend with our lead pastor, Phil Eubank. And just a huge thank you and shout out to those that have helped make Menlo what it is, whether that is you volunteering with your time on Sundays or throughout the week, or being generous with your finances and resources. We just cannot express how grateful we are to those that have said yes to helping Menlo be a place where people can find and follow Jesus. And so we are excited as we're all heading together as a community towards Easter and have plenty of opportunities for those that want to continue what Menlo is doing here to help change the lives of those that are interacting with us on Sundays or online. There will be plenty of opportunities to help out. And so you can talk to anyone at your campus or text our team at 650-600-0402. If you say, yes, I want to help make Menlo the most welcoming and wonderful place for Easter or for our Good Friday service as well. So let's go ahead and jump into today's podcast now. Welcome, everybody, to the Menlo Midweek Podcast. My name is Mark.
My name is Jessica.
Phil's with us today.
Yay!
What's up, everybody? Woo!
Phil, you're not walking with a limp after skiing. You were for a little while.
Yeah, I was, but you know, little by little, every day gets better.
So. Yeah, that's good. Mm-hmm. That's good. The suntan mm-hmm. is still kind of
the glow.
There.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It started as more than a suntan, so I'll take the progress.
Sure. Yeah. And for those that were desperately wondering, if you can see behind Phil there, that was the gift I brought back from Hawaii.
Oh, nice.
Shared some cookies around the office. And Jess was like, where's our decoration for the studio? It's right there.
Look at that. It was a two for one.
Yeah, because those cookies were delicious. Yeah,
they're really good. They're really, really good cookies. Not suffering through eating those cookies.
Or having to go to Hawaii.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, someone has to do it.
We appreciate the suffering that you go through for this.
Mm-hmm. But Phil, bit of a different style message for us this past weekend, speaking of suffering. And I was chatting with the person whose story that we shared before, Jenny, just trying to prep and make sure she was cared for as we shared a little bit of a glimpse into her story, which if you haven't checked that out yet, I will love to encourage you to do so. I'll link it. If you're listening, I'll link it below. And if you're watching, I'll link it up top so you can just click on it. But that story is just incredible. And love that we were able to share that and loved her posture in leading people that have experienced just deep suffering towards what it means to follow Jesus despite circumstances.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So shout out to Jenny.
Yeah.
She's great.
She's like, when we did the volunteer fair back in August, I was in Saratoga and she was like my partner, and she is just the most energetic, lively, bubbly person that you would, you know, never guess that anything bad has happened to her in her life. But it just, like, the spirit of God just comes out of her. It is just so incredible.
Yeah, and that's something that I experienced too while chatting with her, but then also the ability to be equally as real and raw with the other side of that too. And that just was very inspiring for me to listen to and be around. So glad that we could do that. And I felt like that kind of teed up your message around this well. So let's go ahead and summarize that, Phil, and then we'll jump in.
Yeah, so we have been walking with Jesus in his last week of earthly ministry before he would head to the cross. And ultimately what we celebrate on Easter, come back from the grave. And the where we were, you know, with Cheryl teaching, kind of Last Supper, moving from Passover, which, you know, they would have understood that as the Passover celebration meal. They would have had that meal every year of their life, just like that. But Jesus is saying, hey, this is about me. And then that was kind of the high moment of the week, like incredible, until he's like, hey, one of you is about to betray me. And Judas is like, hey, I got to go. And then from there, Jesus goes with his friends, with his closest disciples, and he goes to this unique and specific garden, the Garden of Gethsemane. And he takes Peter, James, and John, his kind of three, like his core, and he said, will you come with me a little closer? Mm-hmm. And then he starts praying. And there's lots of times that we hear about Jesus going off, spending time with his Father, going off and praying. This is the most intimate look that we get between God the Father and God the Son. God the Son talking to God the Father. he knows exactly what's coming, but in his humanity, he feels the weight of it. Mm-hmm. And so you have these successive times where he says, if it's possible, Dad, like, mm-hmm. could there be another way? Is there something other than this cup? What he's saying is cup of suffering, the cross. Is there another path? There's another path available. Can we do that? And then he says, nevertheless, not my will, but yours be done. And he does this over and over again. And every time he comes back to his boys, they're sleeping, which, you know, I talked about, like, we want to be really hard on them for that. But I think all of us would have been sleeping. Like, they're exhausted. Mm-hmm. And it's one of those times, like, you know, maybe you're with somebody, you're with a friend, you're with a family member, and you're watching something late at night, and they're like, don't fall asleep. And you're trying to not fall asleep. I fully believe that his disciples were trying not to fall asleep. And then, you know, Jesus is so overwhelmed. I'm sure it was very disorienting for his friends. He is at one point sweating drops of blood, which is, you know, just a level of emotional, a level of emotional outpouring and exhaustion and overwhelmedness. That this isn't put on, this isn't fake, this is Jesus really showing us what he's facing. And then God the Father sends an angel to minister to Jesus, which is basically God's way of saying, there's no other way, this is the way we're doing it, which is hard, right? That's hard theologically, because God could have done this any way he wanted. He's God. And so when we go, you know, we spent some time in Isaiah 53, like, we don't like those words. It was God's will to crush him. Like, God the Father, and I've heard this described as a divine child abuse, right? You have God the Father crushing and killing Jesus. And I 100% get how, from a human perspective, we would look at that and go, this makes me wildly uncomfortable. And I think that's one way to look at it. I would say, on the other side, how, what does it tell us about the way that God loves us, that he would go to this length, that Jesus, God the Son, would go to this length so that God's plan could ultimately come to fruition? And then what does that tell us about us, right? We talked about this idea that the pain that all of us endure, which is a part of the human experience in a broken world, is a tragedy and a tool. It's not one or the other, it's both. We saw that in Jenny's story. We see that in the story of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, and I think we live it out in ours too.
When we enter into this story, we see this intimate conversation, like you said, between Jesus and his dad. And it shows the humanity within Jesus. So I'd love for you to just expand a little bit on the glimpse at the human Jesus that we get, and how maybe people that might not know how to quantify that with, yes, but he's also God. Did he feel anything at all? Did he feel all the things? Did he know this was going to happen? Let's talk a little bit more about that.
Yeah, well, we talked a little bit this weekend about the, there's a couple theological constructs that we're navigating when we talk about the humanity of Jesus. One is called the hypostatic union, which is the unique combination of divinity and humanity in Jesus. Theologically, we understand that to be 100% divine and 100% humanity. And so you go, okay, but could he sin, right? Which is actually a more open conversation in church world. That's a construct called peccability versus impeccability. You know, the group that believe, there's one group that believes he actually was not capable of sinning. I actually think that Jesus, because he was fully human, and because of another thing I'll talk about in a second called kenosis, I think he actually could have sinned, but yet he didn't, right? Otherwise, I'm kind of like, feels a little bit more like a play act to me, but there's lots of people that are very smart, much smarter than me, that disagree. And then kenosis, which we get from Philippians, right? Jesus, who was God, didn't count equality with God as something to be grasped, but took on the form of flesh, made himself nothing, being obedient even to the form of death. Like, that's where we get this idea that Jesus actually did not choose to tap into his divinity. Like, he, I joke around, like, he never had an S on his chest. He wasn't waving. And then he was like, just living life normal. And he's like, yeah, but this person needs to heal. And he's like, all right, I'm ready to heal you.
That's a movie I'd watch.
Every time that Jesus did miracles, every time that Jesus showed divine power, he did it the same way we would. He did it informed by the Father and empowered by the Spirit. And so then when he says to his disciples, after me, you will do greater things than me, And we're like, that's insane. Why is that? How is that possible? You're God. It's because he wasn't tapping in to this S on his chest. I'm the Son of God, divine nature, the same way in his earthly ministry. And so all those things kind of swim together when we read a passage like this in the Garden of Gethsemane, where we see Jesus absolutely agonizing, for real agonizing. And we see the weight of the burden he's about to experience, right? I think this this idea that I talked about, that, you know, when we go look at the parallel passages of this night, we have lots more details of this night, right? Peter and the guards are going to sit around a fire because at night it's cold. They probably have layers on. They have the fire going. And in that same night, Jesus is sweating profusely. Not only is he sweating profusely from that level of internal turmoil, but the text actually says he is sorrowful, right? Like that just isn't a word we normally think about when we think about Jesus. And then he is sweating so much with so much stress that his blood capillaries burst and he's sweating blood. And so, you know, maybe you've had a day where you felt completely overwhelmed. You've faced something that you can't imagine. Have you ever sweat drops of blood? That's how stressed Jesus was. That's how much in his humanity he knew the weight of what was coming. Matthew says he was sorrowful and troubled to the point of death, which you just think like, what? This is the Savior of the world? Which, as confused as we are with the full picture of the New Testament, imagine his disciples who still are not convinced that he should get arrested and crucified, right? Mm-hmm. They just heard him break it down very directly in the Last Supper, and they're still like, yeah, but like that's still a metaphor, right, Jesus, you know? And so all of that is swirling. And Jesus, you know, he's it's interesting in the Greek, I talked about it this weekend, he's kind of kneeling, praying to the Father, and then he falls down, like prostrate on his face, and is talking to his Heavenly Father and just keeps repeating this prayer, right? Whether he got an answer he didn't like, whether maybe like lots of us, he didn't get an answer, and he just keeps going until eventually this angel comes, and the angel ministering to him is the answer from the Father, which is, here's the strength you need because I'm not letting you change the subject. And I think we watch in this instance the most unique expression of the Trinity of God, God the Father, God the Son, God the Spirit, one God in three persons. We see the most unique expression of that theological concept played out over 10 verses.
Wow. Yeah. That's fascinating. Yeah. Felt like I was there. Just me. So now that we understand that, we can have a better understanding that Jesus felt this at a human level. I'm just curious for you personally, Phil, how does that understanding shape how you have invited Jesus into some of the times in your life where you have also experienced suffering? Because I get that on one hand, the theoretical, God understands, he understands everything, he's always with me, yes, I get that. But then to actually see a lived out example where he went through something that we will never experience, for me, I find that personally comforting. I'm just wondering if you felt the same way.
Yeah, well, I think it's different in ministry when you're a pastor, because when you read passages like the one I've referenced in Hebrews, we have a great high priest who passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast to our confession, for we do not have a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who is in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need. That passage, I would imagine, for the average person is like really helpful. And they go, oh man, so like Phil or my campus pastor, that person that's in my life that's like a professional Christian, I don't need them to be the only answer in my life, that actually I have this great high priest. And for them, they would have thought about the great high priest as it's being written by the author of Hebrews as an actual person. Like to us, we think about that as like some idea, like that's a nice phrase. The high priest was actually a person that every year would go into the Holy of Holies on the Day of Atonement and make a unique and specific sacrifice with a rope tied around their ankle in case that they didn't have, in case they had unaddressed sin in their life, that they could drag them out because they feared for the holiness of God if they went in, and he would make sacrifice for the entire nation of Israel. And that was a temporary sacrifice by a temporary high priest. And here the author of Hebrews is saying, you have a permanent high priest and a permanent and perfect sacrifice. And on top of all of that, the high priest was separate. The high priest was other. They had to live a life that was completely different to stay as unstained from the world as possible. And yet for us, we had this high priest who was separate and other, and Emmanuel, he came and lived with us. Yeah. So if you are somebody that, like, church for you is a thing you go to, I hope that's really encouraging. I think one of the things, maybe if you've been a Christian for a long time, and one of the things for me as a pastor, I think it can be that sort of jump of who's the high priest I think about. I don't have somebody that I go, well, that's the church I go to. That's the person I assume has all the answers. And so I think it takes greater intentionality in the midst of those difficult moments mm-hmm. to say, God, I'm going to release this to you. I'm going to spend time honestly and openly processing the pain that I'm enduring. And then I think extending grace to myself and others through times of difficulty. Sometimes that's a counselor. Sometimes that's a spiritual director. Sometimes that's just in time with the Lord. I think everybody has their own practices to be able to do that. But mm-hmm. the amazing picture that Jesus is both completely and totally perfect. He's completely and totally other. He's completely and totally transcendent. Mm-hmm. And he is one of us mm-hmm. in a way that none of us can even fully comprehend. And I think as you face whatever you're facing, you know, sometimes the lie we tell ourselves is, well, if God knew everything that I've done, every place that I've been, he wouldn't, he would, et cetera. Right. Well, good news. God knows everything you've ever done. Mm-hmm. He knows every place you've ever been. He knows every hidden thought, every wrong motivation. He knows everything you will do that you have yet to know, and he loves you anyway. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, he knew all of that, and he did all of this. That's how much God loves us. Mm-hmm. And so I think the more we can remind ourselves of that reality, mm-hmm. hopefully the more it not only draws us in greater appreciation, but also in greater proximity and relation to God with whatever we face. And yeah. so if you're tempted, you know, what shame and guilt does, shame and guilt says hide. What conviction does and repentance does is it says, God, I actually want to live openly and honestly to you because you know it anyway. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to live with the weight of secrets. I've heard it said before, you know, living a life this side of eternity without sin is impossible. Hopefully, less and less, we're experiencing greater what's called sanctification. It's impossible, though, to live without sin this side of eternity. It is possible to live, though, without secrets. And I think God should be the first one that we just regularly go to and we confess. And we say, God, I am so sorry. I can't believe I did that. I can't believe I thought that. I can't believe I was motivated by that. I can't believe I went down this direction. And I think if you don't have a practice of doing that, not so that God will forgive you, mm-hmm. but because God has already forgiven you, mm-hmm. I bet you're carrying a lot more weight than you need to.
Yeah. Wow. And as I was listening, I also heard the other side of that coin, which is if God saw me where I was, he'd rescue me.
Why doesn't he
take this away? He's supposed to be a good, loving God.
Yeah.
And this also shows an example of sometimes suffering is just what is, like, we have to suffer.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And that's uncomfortable and hard.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I talked about this in the message, but I think on some level, unfortunately, Christianity in the West, my own faith included, we have this idea that the deal we're making with God is mm-hmm. I'll say yes to you mm-hmm. and you'll bring me comfort. Mm-hmm. I'll say yes to you and I'll have less problems, less pain. But when you read the pages of the New Testament, Jesus says, in this world, you will have trouble.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But take heart, I've overcome the world.
Yep.
He says, actually, this world is completely different. Paul says the systems of this world actually are going to hate you. And so what does it mean to live in a world and not to capitulate to that world, not to become an enemy of the people of that world, but to understand that there are systems and structures beyond the people? Paul says that our war is not against flesh and blood, but against powers and principalities, forces of the air and darkness. And because of that, Romans 5 tells us that the primary vehicle, James 1 tells us that the primary vehicle by which we will endure, by which we will grow, is suffering. And nobody wants to hear that.
Wow.
That's not like in the sales pitch. but real hope.
It feels like it should be in the fine print.
Right, right.
No, that's the banner on the street.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Suffering is our primary pathway to spiritual development.
Join us.
But I think, you know, when you go read Romans 5,
yeah.
it's this principle that hope that helps, it hurts to get. Like, there is this weight of How do I understand the suffering that God allows into my life on purpose and for a purpose and walk through it faithfully and learn through that suffering lessons I wouldn't have learned without it? I think it's a C.S. Lewis quote that God whispers to us in our pleasure and he shouts to us in our pain, right? And we don't want that to be true, but it is 100% true. Yeah. And so this idea of like, hey, God, why do you continue to allow suffering in my life? And I think it's because that's what it takes to grow. We see it in nature, right? If you see a tree that's in a serene, perfect environment, that tree will never have the roots grow as deep as it needs to in order to withstand the wind around it. We're in a broken and flawed world. We need deeper roots. And the way those roots come is the winds of suffering in our life.
Yeah. Wow. So Jess, I'm curious.
there's so many things going on in my head.
As our resident seven, all seven on the Enneagram, all the fun, sometimes feelings, but usually if they're good, happy feelings.
Yeah.
How can we, if we want to skate over the suffering parts of our lives, what are some things that have been helpful for you to help feel some of those big, scary feelings?
That's really good. I don't know. Can you teach me? No, I'm just kidding. I mean, that was definitely, I would say, you know, most of my life, I was very blessed with a good, comfortable life and was nothing really horrible ever really happened to me. Mm-hmm. And then you grow up and real things happen. And, man, I think therapy has definitely helped with that. Just trying to understand your emotions. It was, easy for me to just feel and then stop there. Like, I have this bad feeling. Man, that's a bummer. Mm-hmm. I'll pray about it, sleep on it, I'll be fine tomorrow. Literally, like, there may be pain in the night and joy comes in the morning. That was, like, my go-to. Like, great, I'll just sleep it off and I'll be fine. But then once I started really, like, okay, I'm going to sit in this, which is miserable, by the way, but feel like, what is this actually? I remember it was actually an Ortberg sermon. I remember nothing else about this except he said, if you're angry right now, take a minute and figure out what you're mad about. And I sat there and I was like, wow, I actually am really mad right now. And I didn't know, I'd never really, I mean, I've felt that before, but to really pinpoint that. And then I sat with it more and like realized why I was mad and who I was mad at and all this stuff. And so for me, it's been a going to God and saying like, okay, there's something, I feel this bad feeling. Can you tell me, like, sit with God and figure out like, what is that and reveal that to me, whether it's, you know, sadness, it's anger. It's, my, therapist gave me like an emotions chart that like starts big and it like, you might be feeling this way, but then it could be this and this and this, and like goes down into that. And that really helped too, where I could actually pinpoint like, oh, it's not just anger. It's like sorrow, or it's so much deeper than that, because it's this deep seated thing I've been feeling a long time, or it's this thing that someone did to me years ago or whatever it is. So it's so easy to just ignore, sleep it off, try to pray it away. But when we really like dig into what that is, God will reveal something new in us that maybe we didn't even realize we had the capacity for. That emotion as a seven to be angry was like a really weird feeling for me, besides just like being mad at my brother. When you're a kid, you know, and you get mad at your brother. So that's my biggest piece of advice. Go to therapy and sit with God in it and ask him to reveal, what is this feeling? And then how do you actually deal with it? Because it's easy to just, oh, wow, okay, I'm mad. But you have to like actually do something about it, whether it's have, you know, in this instance, I had the conversation with the person of like, I realized I'm actually really mad at you for X, Y, and Z. And, or it's, you know, go to therapy and talk it out and figure out what that looks like and how that all works together.
The parallels that I'm hearing is that you, like Jesus in the garden, spent time and wrestled with these things.
Yeah.
And Jesus was in that garden for hours, long enough for other people to fall asleep.
Yeah.
In the same way that you, instead of sleeping it off, were intentional about pushing in. And so that's something that I'm going to take away from this too, is just when I do feel things or note things, to push in and to invite God into that process, just like Jesus invited the Father into the process.
And so, it's hard. It's not fun.
No.
But
no.
Like you just said, like it's
it
where
ends
we
with
really
sweating blood.
Yeah. Yeah. It's where we can really find a deeper, greater love from our God.
Well, I think that there's a lot of like profound self-awareness to say, hey, this is what I knew I leaned towards. Sure. This is what I needed. Mm-hmm. And I think that that prescription for all of us usually starts by either someone giving us the gift of self-awareness or us doing some work. Yep. Because for you, it may be, hey, I was overly focused on positive emotions to the detriment of more honest emotions. Yep. Mm-hmm. It took wading into some hard conversations in order to surface those and to take meaningful next steps and not just stuff them. Mm-hmm. For other people, shout out Enneagram 4 friends out there, it may be the exact opposite, right? Mm-hmm. It may be that you live in a constant state of melancholy and you actually don't know how to find, like, there is no bright hope of any morning for you, you know? Mm-hmm. And so being willing to recognize, hey, you know what, God, what I need you to do, it starts with where I actually am. And I think for all of us, that's probably different and requires some intentional steps. But hopefully the picture of Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane is, no matter how difficult or painful the spot that you're in is, God can be there with you. And actually, I would argue God is there with you, whether you're even if you're not a Christian. God is there with you, but for him to bring a loving presence, comfort, and you know the same capacity to send an angel to strengthen and minister to Jesus exists for you as well, not to mention the Holy Spirit inside of you. So, you know, the opportunity that we have to look at Jesus, listen to Jesus, and learn from Jesus in the Garden of Gethsemane, that is not a thing that God did 2,000 years ago. It's a thing that God's done for all of eternity and is available to us too.
It's great. Well, Phil, anything that you wrestled with while you were preparing for this? I mean, it's quite the left turn from our let's love each other and wash feet and eat and drink wine.
Yep, yeah. I'm sure it felt that way to Jesus' friends too, right?
Like,
you know, this was a big pivot and all of a sudden it got super, super real of, hey, this thing is coming, this thing is coming. He's been saying it in bits and pieces for 3 years. And then all of a sudden you see Jesus dealing with the emotional weight of it. Mm-hmm. And they had probably this like kind of predictable range of emotions that they saw from Jesus as a well-regulated, emotionally mature, self-aware person. And now all of a sudden it's like, something's wrong. Like something's really wrong. What do we do? And I don't know about you guys, when I have someone in my life who's like really upset, especially in the throes of it, it takes every ounce of me to like be present with that person and not try to fix it. Mm-hmm. And you know, Peter was trying to fix it.
Yeah.
You know, Peter was trying to fix it. Yep. And meanwhile, you got Judas who's already off doing whatever. And all the guys are like, what happened with, you know, like there are all these murmurs taking place while they're exhausted, while they're falling asleep, while they're going, I wonder what we're going to do tomorrow, having no meaningful idea of the weight of it. And so I think it's such a rich passage that I think it's, I don't think this passage tempts me to go like into Bible professor mode, but I think it does tempt me to just like go completely into the passage, which I may have done, and like spend so much time there that I leave too much to an individual to go, okay, so what do I do with this, you know? And so I hope that, you know, Spirit of God moves in people's lives, that spending time actually in the narrative itself gives them a vision or a hope of what God can do if we would bring our real, honest longings, frustration, anger, tragedy, and understand that God can be with us in the midst of that. It's painful and difficult, and he is using it like the potter to shape and change us into a vision for the future that we would have never become if it weren't for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I want to know what if, let's say, our community leans in super hard, and we commit to trying to enter into this well, posture ourselves well, What can the future of Menlo look like if we're a community of people that address the real things in ways that we think are healthy, in ways that we think are God-guided? What would that look like for us as a community 5-10 years from now?
Yeah, I think there is a way where this conversation becomes very myopic, becomes very self-focused. And I think there's a piece of it that's that, to say, you know, put the oxygen mask on yourself before you put it on your kids, right? But I think there is also this really important realization of there are people around us right now. And will you go, hey, you know what? I'm not where I need to be with God. Or there's frustrations in my life and unaddressed pain from my past. Trust me, I get it. And being able to pursue a meaningful hope in the midst of that and growing deeper in our faith is really important. But I think, you know, I don't know if I've mentioned on the podcast, three groups of people that I regularly think about when I'm doing message prep are saints, skeptics, and prodigals. And, you know, I think it, I hope that a decade from now, Menlo has a strengthening voice around what does it mean, as Paul would say, to give the community around us, to give a defense for the hope that it was within us, right? Language we might use would be, what does it mean for Menlo to not just be undivided followers, not just be unhurried friends, not just be sacrificial developers, but to be thoughtful witnesses? What would it look like if we cared so much, not just about what God was doing in us, but through us in our neighborhoods, at our workplaces, in our communities, at our schools, where this level of anxiety about the suffering that Jesus was going to go through and the weight that was going to carry, what would it look like for us to feel a level of sorrow? What would it look like for us to live into this level of surrender for the neighbors that live across the street from us? And the sense of like, well, they're just not faith people, it's fine. To go, no, like I know the life that they're giving up. I know the eternity that they're walking into. And I am experiencing so profoundly and deeply God's love for me, even in the most difficult parts of my life. I want that for them. I'm praying that for them. I care for them. I'm investing in their life. I long for Menlo to be a place where it's not just I look around and there's a full room and isn't this nice, but to say there are people that God has placed close to me who are far from the relationship he died to provide. And the level of sorrow and anxiety that Jesus was willing to embrace so that we could know him, we would be reminded that God, he sent his son so that they, whoever they are in your life right now, whoever you think in your moral circle of people you care about and people who don't, could know him too. Mm-hmm. And what would it look like for our level of compassion to look like Jesus?
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Well, if you need any prayer requests, or if you have any prayer requests, have any questions.
If you need any prayer requests, yeah, we can give you some.
We can give you some, too. You can text our team, 650-600-0402.
I do have a question, though.
Yes.
To close us out.
Sure.
We have Easter coming, a couple weeks. My assumption is that our listeners here have been to many at Easter services.
Okay.
Why should they come to our service on Easter Sunday? What's going to be...
And why should they bring friends and family?
Yeah. I just think, like, you know, I've heard this message so many times, and yet it still impacts me.
Okay.
So, like, what is it about Easter that's going to make people want to come?
Yeah, I think a lot of it really comes down to, hopefully, if you're a follower of Jesus, you recognize that Easter is dual nature, right? You're not coming to hear a new sermon.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, you're coming to celebrate. You're celebrating... even if we did the exact same set list and the exact same creative elements from a year ago, which we're not, but even if we did, you're different, right? So make a different you and a different that, and it's, you know, it's going to feel like Easter, but it's going to feel hopefully like, oh, where God's brought me over the course of the last year, I can engage with the celebration of Easter differently. If you've been with us through this series, really the reason that we practice Lent this way is so that Easter feels more full, feels more significant. Yeah. Yep. And so, you know, we have these like Stations of the Cross at campuses the week before for you to engage with. Like these are all opportunities for us to say, okay, what does it look like to really understand and experience Easter for the scale that it meaningfully could be? I think that's one layer that we experience Easter. The other is all the things I just talked about of compassion that we have for people who are close to us but far from the relationship that Jesus died to provide. Easter is one of just a couple times in the year where the easiest conversation you have is, hey, where are you going to Easter? Is your family going to Easter somewhere? Hey, does your family want to come to Easter with us? Hey, what are you guys having? Even softer, you know, like where are you guys having lunch for Easter?
Sure.
Do you want to have lunch with our family for Easter? Oh, we're going to church right before that. Do you want to come with us? Like those conversations, there is not any lower hanging fruit than those conversations. And if you have not experienced an Easter service with an unchurched friend next to you, I'm telling you, it'll be the best Easter experience of your life. You just watch God move in the heart of people. So yeah, I think it'll be a great service. I think it'll be really fun at all of our campuses. I think it's worth you going to, and it's not about you.
Yeah.
The reason that we do Easter differently is not primarily for the people who know Jesus at Menlo. It's so that the people who know Jesus at Menlo can leverage Easter for the people who don't.
Yeah.
And so I really hope that people take advantage of it that way.
Yeah. And another piece of low-hanging fruit, if you have kids, each of our campuses is doing an Easter egg hunt after their 11:30 service.
That's right. That's right.
So that's an easy, like, hey, oh, yeah, by the way, church. Oh, but then there's an Easter egg hunt and we can do lunch.
That's right. That's exciting.
Mm-hmm. I've loved the language you used to in the past where when we do these services for with people, with our congregation in mind that they will be bringing others, that we will not make it weird.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
So we are not going to make this Easter weird. We approach weekends like this through the lens of there are people that may that maybe haven't been here in a year or church before in general.
Yep. Right.
So that's our starting point for these. So we're encouraging you. We're rooting you on. If you need, again, prayer or encouragement in this process, we'd love to chat with you around that. So text our team. Have a great week, everybody. And we'll see you on campus somewhere soon.
Go to menlo.church/Easter for all of that. Bye.
Bye, everybody.